Well, this is a very special episode. Today we are joined by Louie's daughter, Christina Thomas, all the way from the coast, who's here visiting over the holidays. And we're so grateful to have you here today, Christina. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
I'm like so thrilled to have you here because I know that you're also very curious about Sahuapmec culture and you are working on the coast and working towards your master's next, working with the Songhees First Nations, correct? And I'm so curious about how that's going for you.
I would like to say it's going well. So I am here from Victoria. I've been living there for about 5 years now. I moved there to go to the University of Victoria right after high school. I started out just wanting to get my bachelor's in political science and then move into law school. But while I was in my political science degree, I realized that law has no space for me. So I decided to tack on an Indigenous studies major in addition to my political science major and then move into policy and governments work because that's where I wanted to end up ultimately. And I thought a law degree would kind of give me the credibility that I needed. But I realized very quickly that law can be fickle. So I decided to go that way. And last summer, I started working for the Songhees First Nation in the Clinical Services Department. So I started out as a summer student, counting needles and Band-Aids. And now I'm their accreditation coordinator. So I write all of the policy, I work on quality improvement standards, and I continue to count Band-Aids and needles.
You know, I am also a bit of a policy nerd. I find policy really exciting. And I know a lot of people don't. They just don't understand. Do you find policy exciting?
I love policy and I love talking about my work, but I brought it to chief and counsel down there once talking about it and I just saw the light leave their eyes. Like nobody wants to talk policy, but I really do enjoy it.
That's so great. Louie, how do you feel about that? Your daughter's changing the world.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited for her, you know, and I think she's come a long ways, you know, and, you know, watching her grow up. And I realized, you know, that most of our young people were never really got involved too much into our culture. And they have to go to university to learn about it. Why is it? You know, and I think this is a question that Tina should be answering.
That's kind of a question that everybody has about going off to school and then coming back to your community in general. But for you, it's a different thing because culturally there are a lot of gaps and it seems like there's more information and more, you know, academia, more research coming out now in post-secondary institutions to kind of help fill that gap. Are you finding that that's happening?
Yeah, I would say so. I think there's a lot of complexities when you bring Indigenous politics, culture, and academia together. I've got a lot of problems with it. But in terms of my experience, I guess, I think when I was in university, I realized how much I actually learned from my father and from the community more generally. I worked with a lot of Indigenous students. I found a really great community there. And there's really only a few of us that actually grew up on the reserve and grew up in our own communities. A lot of us who make it into the university, grow up in urban centers or in the foster system. You know, they live away from their communities and then from that they're given opportunities to, or they're shown the way towards university, right? Like it's not a conventional path. And my dad and I have talked about that a lot is how do we get our own community members out there? But I guess going back to the original question, yeah, when it comes to culture, it was interesting to kind of revisit it through the lens of like political and historical inquiry, I guess, while you're studying. You really learn how much you learned about your culture when so much of it is a blank slate, especially when it comes to the culture of the interior people. There's a lot on the coastal people, but it was really interesting for me to be able to fit the gaps of my own understanding of culture with, I guess, kind of the mold of understanding, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, it's a complex situation, right? Like with a lot of Indigenous communities struggling with the healing first and then to fill those cultural gaps. It's not step one, step two. The information and the guidance and the traditional knowledge all has to kind of come together in a way that is, you know, community driven rather than, you know, settler driven. So it's really, yeah, it's a tough time to kind of pull all those pieces together to make sense of your history and your community's history.
Yeah, going back to my word salad just a minute ago, I think that there's in academia especially, and when you're working with Indigenous people from all over the place, there's kind of an understanding of what culture is, right? It's something we define, it's something we learn about, and we have culture. We have set definitions for it. But the interesting thing about being from the interior, being Suquamish specifically, is that you kind of have to work to fill in the gaps of that for yourself. And I guess that's what I was getting at earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to make sense here.
And then you've got this incredible dad who has a lot of that knowledge just tucked away in that really beautiful brain of his. And that's what we've been doing in this show, is pulling these memories and these stories from Louis so that we could better understand Suquamish history and the true history of this land. So yeah, you must be feeling a bit of pressure now, Louis, to now that your daughter's in master's mode.
Yeah.
you got to really pull out the information.
Well, you know, I never looked at myself as an academia or anything, you know. I just got involved in the culture, and I think that's what kind of sobered me up and led a totally different life than when I grew up, you know. And so to me, it was just about self-improvement of myself. It wasn't about anything else, and I wanted to teach everybody, but it seemed like the interest was never really there. It was the trauma of colonialism, or, you know, the fear of relearning your culture. Because I think everybody needs something to believe in. We all got our creator, and it's similar to everybody else's God, you know. So there's no difference between me and a Roman Catholic or an Anglican, but, you know, because we all have the kind of the same beliefs. But yet that separation of or segregation of culture, people, is always going to be there. You know, I don't know why, but it's always been an enigma kind of to me, you know, why people can't get along, because, you know, we all have the same beliefs. You know, when you really look at everybody's religion or spirituality, it's just that I think the colonials have a right. They stress more on rights than obligations. We are obligated to do better for others. It's not a right. It's an obligation to do what is best for people. And I think that was the way of our people for centuries. You know, they had an obligation to look after their people.
When you say obligation, I think about how you have to be listening and responding rather than reacting and doing what you think might be the best thing. What I've been learning about a lot of Indigenous communities is that it's all about consensus and communication and figuring out what the land needs. That wasn't a question, was it? So, Christina, we've got this opportunity here with you working towards your master's. You've got an advisor sitting right here next to you. But I know that he's been in your life like this whole time, all these years, and maybe some of the memories and the stories and the knowledge that he's shared with you has already kind of led you down this road that you're on. Is there any connection to that? Do you feel like there's been this the torch, so to speak, being passed on?
That's a way to put it that I don't think I quite deserve yet, but I do appreciate that. But when it comes down to it, I think my father has taught me a lot about leadership and what it means to be community oriented, and I really take that to heart in my studies, in my work, in my personal relationships. I absolutely have learned a lot from him about that kind of consensus-based approach that we were talking about, and that you can be as bullheaded as a leader as you want to be. You're not going to get anywhere if you don't have the community behind you. So that's something that I really bring into every aspect of my life, I would say. But when it comes down to it, I don't think there's ever been an instance where I interviewed my dad about what leadership really looks like. I think I've only kind of picked it up from being raised by him. So I would love to ask my dad what, in your terms, leadership and representing your community and kind of the path forwards, I want to hear it in your words.
Well, I've been trying to be a leader all my life, and it seems like leadership role has always been my nemesis, so to say. And I didn't really want to be. I'm kind of like an independent thinker, you know, and I do my own thing. I think it was because of the way I grew up. I grew up on the land. Then when I started getting into trouble, well, then my life took a different turn. Then till I started realizing I was going in the wrong direction, so I had to redirect myself. And maybe that's why I don't talk about it too much anymore, you know, because I don't want anybody to make the same mistakes I did. And I think the only way you could learn is probably from other people's mistakes too. And I guess maybe shame or I never really talk about it much because, it's a hard thing to do, to introspect yourself and to say, well, you know, I woulda, shoulda, coulda. And I tried my level best to be a kind of leader that the people need. And I don't think I've ever achieved that, you know. I've only went so far, and I don't think I've ever earned that big war bonnet or, you know, the big ceremonial headdress. Because I know a good leader should know a little bit about everything nowadays, because we're in a different era. Education now is important to our people, but it's still understanding who we are. One of the things that I talk about, you know, because, now we have community meetings and we don't have our kids there because, you know, traditionally everybody was at community meetings. Nowadays, is it that from colonialism where, oh, we can't have the kids there because they're too noisy there? And you just made an example to me as to why it's important, because you watched me and I never realized you were, you know, so... It goes to say that I never really practice what I preach. You know, and just in the last few years, I realized, you know, when we go to community meetings, there's hardly any kids there. And then when they grow up, they think, well, maybe we don't belong there. You know, it's same as residential school or whatever. And we don't really look at it that way now, because before, everybody was involved in everything. And it's surprising what little kids can pick up, you know, and they... start to understand that it's important to have meetings to get things done. And we don't do that anymore, you know, and then kids grow up feeling that, well, we're not involved, so why should we worry? Shove that responsibility on to somebody else, you know, the onus is on them, not on you if you take part in it. You try to see what I'm getting at? And I think that's one of the reasons why we're not a community anymore. You know, we're a segregated community, and I struggle with that all the time.
Well, I know you weren't a kid at the time, but you worked for many, many years with your mom, Dr. Mary Thomas,
yeah.
And you did exactly what you're just talking about, right? You learned from her, and you have told me in the past how you never intended to be in the spotlight. That was her job, to be in the spotlight. You were just the backstage manager, and yeah. Yet here you are.
Well... I don't think I've ever achieved her greatness, but I work at it, let's put it that way. I'm just hoping some of my learnings do rub off on the younger people, you know, and start understanding, you know, the education part is important. We got to stop, like I keep reminding people, you know, we got to stop thinking Swak Mahulu as individual band, because one wise old Indian said, you know what, we're all Kalmuk. In Kalmuk Uluk, we're in the land of the natives, the people. And if you look at it from the tip of North America to the tip of South America, it's all Indian land. Yet we don't communicate with each other now. We're so separated. And if we keep saying Swak Mahulu, we're going to be separated for time immemorial. And if we start learning about Kalmuk Uluk, because I talked about this with the elders up at Banff, and I told him the same thing, you know, we got to stop thinking, you know, Swak Mahulu, because it's all Kalmuk Uluk. And they said they really liked what I said, you know, because, you know, that should be the way of our people. We're all related, just like we are related to the plants, the animals, everything.
Well, it's all part of the what makes you an effective leader. And I can tell you, Christina, from the point of view of a settler who was running a nonprofit organization, Louis has been the best leader because he connected constantly. He stopped in, we'd talk, we'd plan, we'd work on all kinds of projects together. And it was because he used his legs, right? Walked through the doors, went and met with people, had coffee with people, talked with people, learned from people, and then people learned from him. And that's been the best example of what a really wonderful community leader is.
Mm-hmm. Somebody who actually gets out into the community.
Yeah, and you talk about, you have your master's in community studies, I can tell you. You've learned it all. I'm saying to Louis. You still have to work at it, Christina.
Yes, ma'am.
So tell me about how this connects in terms of leadership. I've always told Louis, this is kind of funny, because ever since you were a teenager and and we knew how brilliant you were. I've said, well, that's going to be our next prime minister. And I've always said that every time he talks about you, because he's so proud of you and everything you're doing, I say, well, it's just one more step on the way to prime minister. So I'm pretty excited about that. I can't wait for that to happen. But yeah, like, how does this kind of story and information and his being a role model affect how you imagine yourself in the future?
Well, there's just so many instances to relay, but I think when I first realized my identity as an Indigenous person, coming from an Indigenous family in my community, I realized how early advocacy was going to play a role in my life. So I was the elementary school advocate for my little cousins, you know, because, yeah, elementary school kids can be pretty brutal. So you kind of grow into these things, right? You learn about racism, you learn about misogyny and sexualized violence, and you learn about inequality in the healthcare system, and it just compounds until it seems so overwhelming. And that's what led me to choose political science over nursing, is I wanted to be able to have the language, the vocabulary, and the piece of paper to make me a credible advocate, regardless of which community I was in. So I would say that I learned a lot from my dad in terms of leadership style and being able to coordinate with different people, whether it's teachers, professors, students, community members, to get a message across, right? It's always about how hard can you put your message across sometimes. That's really what it comes down to. Yeah, my interest now is healthcare. I feel like everything that I've learned in my life kind of comes to this path. Being able to practice my culture and my identity and my teachings, I feel like that environment is best for me. It's a best fit, I would say.
Well, that's exciting, because I didn't know you were interested in nursing at first. And so that is a great match.
I think, too, you know what, when you think about it, you know, my mother is one that started that legacy making. I think it's that contribution you do. And no matter what kind of a mark you leave in the land when you leave, you always seem like you have to contribute something, whether big or small. Legacy I leave, I think, is kind of insignificant to what Mum did. I just following in her footsteps, and she's still kind of leading me around, you know, without me realizing it. Her and Kia, my grandmother, still leading me around by the nose, and I kind of think they tell me what to do. So when people say, well, why are you over here? And I said, well, I don't know, the Creator sent me, you know. So you never know where you're going when you're doing something, maybe something good. You never know where you'll end up. So my advice is to just relax and let the Creator take you to where you want to go, you know, because look at you now. You know, you wouldn't think that you'd be in a Songhees band and working for them and starting to get really involved more into the culture, you know. And so it's that direction that you take is important. You know, some people call it the red road. I call it the road to self-improvement. When you're doing the right thing always comes up. And if you keep going, you never know where it'll take you. Maybe you'll be leaving your own legacy behind. That's why when I told you when you did that little radio show, you and Emily, I told them, you know what, you're leaving a little legacy. It might have been significant to you at the time, but you know, down the road, maybe you might have grandchildren that come up, Grandma, I heard you on the radio. And you know, because you never know what kind of a legacy you're leaving until you really put your mind to it. And hopefully that one day you'll achieve what you really want to do. I know I don't think I'll ever achieve what I really want to do, but I work at it, you know, slow but sure. But I never had the education level that everybody had, and my lifestyle wasn't that great. I didn't have a dad for a role model. You know, I grew up rebellious and hating everybody, seemed like it, and a lot of anger issues. But you know, somehow I overcame it. It keeps rearing itself up every once in a while, but the anger builds up in me, and thank God for the sweat house. And you've been up mine a few times and laughed at her. You know, she learned part of the culture. She learned how to build a fire. When you went out to a bush party, she's the only one that knew how to make a fire.
True melding of skills.
Because I get her to help build a fire up there for me sometimes. At one time, I thought it was them outside the door there, and I was going to holler at them to go away. I opened it here. There was a big bear, wet bear paws going by the front of the sweat house.
Oh, gosh.
I guess he went out of sweat or swim in my pool while I was inside.
While you were busy, I guess. Oh, my gosh. Do you have to have your own sweat house? Like, do you have to make your own, or do you use his?
When I was younger, I used his, but traditionally men and women are supposed to have their own, two different medicines. Yeah. So I think the plan is for my older sister and I to build one in the spring next to my dad's, so we're going to be getting to that.
And I heard about this little pool. I think it's a pretty nice little setup that he's got going on.
Oh, it's beautiful. I haven't been up there for years, but I spent a lot of time up there when I was a kid.
I'd like to hear more about your experiences as a kid then, about your like cultural and traditional values and activities and ceremony and anything that was kind of, you know, like special and new to you, because growing up and going to Salmon Arm West, did you go to Salmon Arm West?
Yeah.
Then, you know, you're kind of plunked into this colonial system, experiencing racism and otherness, and yet you have this really incredibly rich culture at home. Like, how much integrating were you able to do when you were a kid?
I think I would say a lot. I'm very fortunate. My sister and I, we spent a lot of time outside. And I think you can learn so much about yourself and your family when you're engaging with them all the time. I mean, you don't need to talk about screen time and staying indoors and all that. But my sister and I were always outside, and my dad was always leading the charge. We always, in the summer, we would go berry picking. We were skating on the river in the winter and swimming in it in the summer. We were always outside, and we were allowed to have our own freedom, I guess is what I'm saying. So through that, my sister and I learned a lot, I would say, about the plants and the animals and how to be safe and mindful of your environment and how to work with it as well. Like I said, I spent so many days total probably up at my dad's sweat house. I feel like I spent half my childhood up there, because that's where I had a lot of my memories, was going out there and learning what to do when you encounter a bear in the field, right? Like, not a lot of 7-year-old girls were out there doing that. So I think, we were just all over the place when we were kids, whether it was around the house, on the rock bluffs at the top of the mountains, Fly Hills, going to the caves up in Mount Ida, or driving out to Clearwater to get lava rocks for my father's sweat house. We were always outside getting dirty.
That's the best learning.
Definitely.
And so we've talked an awful lot about plants, and medicinal plants and food plants. Traditional food plants on the show in the past few weeks. So was your dad able to show you some of the food plants that are still growing out there, how to identify them, how to prepare them, things like that?
Yeah, definitely. Preparation is something that I would like to learn more about from my father and from my Auntie Lorna. But when it comes to plant identification, sometimes it surprises me the knowledge that's buried away in there somehow. Like my dad rediscovering that he had the language, I've rediscovered just from being outside and in passive conversations with my father that I know a little bit more than I thought. So it's really interesting to be able to kind of transcribe that knowledge from here to a new environment completely on the South Vancouver Island is, oh, I know what these things are. You know, when you're in tune with your environment and you know how to do those things, you can pick it up much faster than other places. So when it comes to plant identification and being out there and knowing their uses, I absolutely learned a lot, I would say.
Well, you know, I was more curious, you know, was there any really traumatic, when you were going to school, you know, I know I didn't communicate too much with you, you know, I didn't get too involved in your school, you know, I went to a lot of your recitals and everything, you know, I dragged myself to it, and but, you know, it's not like your half-brother Mark. When he was in the cadet, and he went to Vernon for a summer, I didn't find out until way later that, you know, they really razzed him over there, so he had to quit. And he didn't tell me. Otherwise, I'd have went after them, you know, because that was the same time that Oka crisis was on in back east, and all the army was over there getting ready to fight the savages and... And yet Mark was one of the few natives that were in the army over there, or the cadets. So he got the brunt of it, and he didn't tell me. When he came back, he quit. And I didn't force him. I never forced anything on my kids. You know, they have the right to learn other ways. I know my other kids, they went to Five Corners Church. Their mother took them to different churches, and And everybody said, well, it's not the old way. And I said, no, it's the old way. The people have to learn their own spirituality. But my son, he didn't tell me. I think that's embedded in him, you know, the trauma of rejection, racism. And I didn't know until maybe about 5 years later that why he quit the cadets, you know. And I'm just wondering if anything like that ever happened to you in school. But I know things are a little bit different nowadays with our kids going to school than it was when I was going there, because we were a real minority then. I think there's only about 8 of us going to school from the res. The rest were going to residential. I'm just wondering if there was any event that you might have had when you were going to school.
Like I said about elementary school, that's kind of when I first realized my otherness. You know, kids have a way of being very direct, right? And when you're 5 years old, you don't understand racialization and economic disparities and things like that. But when it comes down to growing older, and especially as an Indigenous woman, I faced a lot of really surprising behavior from men in my, or I guess boys, I should say, in high school. Like, there's an instance of somebody who told me casually that he was planning to go down to the reserve this weekend and pick off some Native girls. And I just couldn't believe it. You know, he was saying that to me to, like, let me know that his intention was to go harm my family. And I mean, I brought that to the attention of the school right away. That's a legitimate threat, and it didn't go very far. So I would say that that's just one instance. I mean, at those bush parties where I was making fires, there's always somebody who has something to say about how easy Native girls are and about how, you know, like, this isn't the most pleasant conversation, but it is. The reality is that Indigenous men they encounter a lot more violence and aggression, and Indigenous women have to deal with a lot of sexual violence and sexual comments. And I am so grateful that I never experienced the physicality of that, but I know that a lot of my cousins and my relations can't say the same. So I would say that is what really radicalized me into being in a position of leadership, because it's so easy to feel powerless when you're in those situations. It's in the 21st century, in 2020, you know, when I was still in high school, we were having these conversations. I just couldn't believe the immaturity and the lack of will to do anything about it, because it's been centuries of this now. And no woman is exempt from it. But as an Indigenous person experiencing this, I mean, everything is just compounded. So I would say that, yeah those are my traumas.
Yeah, but you know, that's no different than when it was back in the 50s. The white guys, they thought the same thing. Oh, we'll go get the Native people, the Native women. They're easier, an easy target, because they won't say anything or anything. You know, I've heard this a lot of times when I was growing up. Things have never really changed 50 years ago to now.
The obligation is on settlers and colonial structures to educate their young men. Like, that's where the obligation lies. In a way, that's kind of where those efforts really start, is changing the structures. Mm-hmm. It's terrible to say, you know, boomers and the Gen Xers or whatever you want to call us tend to kind of have a bit of a hands-off, like, oh yeah, you know, the next generation will fix this. This is no problem. But we are the ones who actually have experienced all of this change and turmoil and all the things. So we are kind of perfectly situated to help that process. But we definitely have to be led by you, led by a generation that is thinking differently, thinking outside the system.
Yeah, that's something that I learned from my father, I think. And it's something that I bring up every single time that I can, is just how important accountability is. You're accountable to your community, you're accountable to yourself, you're accountable to your family, and you have to be able to, and I think that's the strength of our communities that existed pre-contact and in the very early days, was that we were accountable to each other. And I just feel like that is something that is absolutely lost. I mean, our communities are getting bigger, they're more diverse. You know, who can you be accountable to all the time, right? Like, our networks are huge, but our values are so, we believe that they're so different now. I just think accountability is such a big one, and we have to be able to have systems, you know, that's what I said, the law fickle system, or the the legal system can be fickle. It's not really a system for accountability, right? Like, we've seen that time and time again. So yeah, I would say maybe that's at the crux of my teachings from my dad, is how to be accountable to your community and show up for them maybe even when you're not needed, right? Like you always have to be there. You can't just be there in times of crisis. So yeah, I think about that a lot as a youth, as a woman, as an Indigenous person, is it's very easy to fall into that victim mindset. But at the end of the day, you're still accountable to yourself and to your community.
I think this is a very valuable inquiry about the things that you've learned just by being present with your dad and with your family members and your siblings and all your relations, that you can absorb a heck of a lot more learning that way than any classroom where you're sitting listening to a lecture at the front of the room. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with your dad that you learned from him?
Something that sticks out, and once again, it's not the lightest of topics, but I must have been maybe in the fifth grade, and my father and I went down to the graveyard at the end of the reservation, and we were just walking along the rows, kind of cleaning things up a little bit, and he said, look at all the dates on the crosses. And I did my calculations, and 30 years old, 32, 29, it was all really, really young people that were passing before they got to live a full life, to things like addiction and family violence and, you know, the outfall of colonization. So I think I took a lot of that with me as I grew older and I learned more about the world beyond my family unit. And I think about that now when you said that, you know, how do you like get up and face the day? You have to wake up and you got to look at what's ahead of you. In the past year or so, we lost 11 young people in our community again. So it's just unbelievable how we measure progress, right? But yeah, I think it is really challenging. And it's something that as somebody who did make it off the reserve and go to university and get a decent job, it's something that I think about at the end of the day is my community is still going through the same things that they were 50, 20 years ago. Like, what is really changing? So when it comes to responsibility and leadership, like we could have a billion exemplary examples, it feels like, and there's always a problem at the end of the day.
I understand what you're saying, that the loss to all the traumatic reasons that there are to so many Indigenous folks who are so young, it feels like hopelessness is at the core of so much of that. How do we even begin to address that in terms of policy? Like, do you think that there's things in there that you can affect change with that might actually help communities with that?
Yeah, I mean, I sure hope so. I think it'll be a lifelong journey. Like my dad said, he never measured up to my grandmother, and I feel like I'll never measure up to him. Like, it takes a lifetime, right? And I just think that it's the small things that add up. I mean, you never know where your life is going to go. But I think despite me being somewhat of a pessimist about progress, I think there are a lot of really incredible young Indigenous people at the forefront now who are getting things done, who are saying no to the challenges. You know, we're always, every day there's a new ridiculous challenge, and I think ultimately it is about collecting our agency and our autonomy and getting together and standing up to these things. And I think it is happening. I think it's happening slowly. As always, it could always be faster.
I always bring that up, you know, because originally we were a community. Now we got a diverse community. And I think we got to start relearning that word community, to start developing a different way. Because what does it mean to be a Canadian? We really don't have any significant, we know we talk about maple syrup and kokanee beer or, you know, things like that. But what is it to be Canadian? I think we got to go back to our basic need of community development, not just a Suwakmuk or Nisqually community or Salmon Arm community. But I think we got to start learning, because I always bring that up. We can't, you know, we're supposed to be caretakers of the land. We're Yukumanulu, you know, we're caretakers of the land. But what do we do to look after? We don't do anything, because it was taken away from us, that responsibility. All we can do is brag about it. But I think the only way we could do it now is getting the whole community together to start acting like a community, not a segregated community. And this is what I keep advocating for, because we can't fix anything. They already put us in a little jail, so to speak, you know, on a reserve. And you stay there and be a good little Indian. You could look at what's going on. All our trees are gone. All our salmon are gone. All our buffalo are gone. Everything is disappearing. What's going to be left? No, I got a phone call from Banff that woke up a bear because it's interrupting the skiers coming down the hill. So they woke him up and chased him out of his home. Is that right? You know, to me, that they tried doing that to us for centuries, tried to kick us out of our own home, move us somewhere else where we might do less harm to them. So I think that, you know, we got to stop thinking about, you know, our own little community. You know, we got to start developing a stronger community where it's more integrated, so we could all learn how to sit down and tackle us like our old people did for centuries. We sat down and worked out our problems as a whole, but yet that separation is still there, and it's going to take how many years to change it. And I think that nobody really advocates for that, because, you know, we still look at ourselves as individual, and we're not. We're no different than the bear. We're no different than the Iraqi. We're no different than the Aborigines from Australia. We're all do the same thing. We're all here for one purpose, and that's to die. But what we do from the day we're born to the day we pass away is what kind of contribution do we give? We actually did that with the Salmon River Roundtable. You know, we worked on that as a more like a community. And it's kind of like that with the Trail Roundtable now. But it still doesn't reach out to the whole community.
That's the thing about these models have worked really well on that small scale. But how do you scale up, right?
Yeah.
And make that a municipal sort of way of being without air quotes consultation model that they've got going on right now. And then how do you scale up regionally and scale up provincially? And think about things, think about the people and the land, not with boundaries and borders, but with interests and responsibilities to the land. That's just really complex, right? Like, I think you've made some pretty great inroads when you have led some of these collaborative groups and been a voice at the table that has helped lead a lot of people into a more land-based way of thinking. Man, we need that on a much bigger scale.
Yeah, accountability. It's a word that I will say until the end of time. I think it's crazy that we live in an environment where we just accept that politicians lie, that our leaders lie. Even on a municipal level, there's always rumors and gossip. And I think that we have to be accountable to each other, and we have to hold our leadership accountable, or we'll never get anywhere. And we have to expect better of each other. We can't tolerate the bare minimum for the sake of getting along, because it doesn't work anymore. And I mean, it never has. So I think, yeah, that's the core of it. I just don't know how we get that message out there.
And I mean, the world is changing so fast right now, right? It's just, it makes your head spin to think about how many things have changed just in the last 10 years. I'm not sure it's better because, you know, we've lost a lot of personal connection just, you know, throughout the pandemic and everything. So there's just a lot of challenges that way too. And people still adjusting to technology and things that are kind of coming up that we're not really ready for. But, you know, these people with their sitting in their little rooms and their computers are inventing anyway. So yeah, like how do you really bring accountability back to the conversation when we're just also overwhelmed with the rapid, you know, technological progress we're making and the new systems, the new everythings that people feel like, oh, I'm just going to check out and sit in my tiny room and scroll on Instagram.
I mean, I think the best that we can do is the kind of work that my father does, is just getting out there and reconnecting with people. All it takes is one person to make another feel seen. I mean, how many stories do we hear of where that changes people's lives? I think just getting out there and doing your best to not spend every day on Instagram is step one, right? It's so easy to do that. But just getting out there, saying hello to people, I think that's what we need to do to rebuild that community. I think people are desperate to have their communities back. We've seen that with the rise of certain political ideologies, is ultimately it's about wanting your community back. But people are just desperate for connection. So yeah, I think we are obligated to connect with people in any way that may come across in your daily life.
That is the one thing about safety, right? We all see safety when we have a place to belong. Yeah. Belonging is just so critical.
Yeah. Well, I kind of talk about that too. When I first went up my sweat house, I said I heard the laughter of our old people up and down this valley. Now when I go up there, all I hear is words of anger in many different languages. because of that communication level that we got nowadays, you know, we know what's going on the other side of the world while it's still happening. So we know we got to start looking at things differently because, you know, we don't know how to communicate anymore, but yet we talk about communication. We got phones, iPads, computers, but yet we don't stop and talk to each other. If we want to talk to somebody, we message them. And, you know, so we just don't know how to communicate anymore. And when I look back at our chief and council days, we don't communicate. You know, we're too busy trying to be politicians. And we forget about, you know, that we're human too. The less we communicate, the more problems we're going to create. So I think that it's a changing world. And somehow or another, the answer is there. And it's AI doesn't have the answer to us because, you know, we put the thoughts into it. And it's going to create the same ideology or whatever into what we created. So I think that we have to go back to the old system of talking to each other, nose to nose. Even if we don't like what we say, well, we got to learn how to accept what the other person people say. Because our people was looking at everything. We're related to everything. We're even related to the rock, common rock. It's got a feeling too. If you hold it long enough and cup it in your hand, you'll feel it's getting warmer all the time. So you're kind of putting life into it. Same with the plant. You know, they just realize that you can talk to it. Same with the animals. You can talk to it. And the birds, it's got a language of its own. And squirrel, you know, but we got to learn how to communicate with them too. You know, they're running into their problems now, and we all are, you know, and that's what the scary part is. We don't know how to work together as a community to really combat all the problems that we've created in the past. I said maybe the land is going to get mad because it's starting to fight back now, and I could see that more and more because we don't know how to look after it. We just keep taking and taking. And all our Chiptaqua, let's say that, if you keep taking and taking, somebody's got to pay.
In regard to that, the plants, like that was a really critical thing that I learned from you, Louis, is about how the plants are speaking to us and we just have to learn how to listen. Yeah. And that's a really great model for human interaction as well. And science is just now catching up to, you know, what Indigenous people have known for about 15,000 years. And that is that everything is genuinely connected. We actually know that now. Science tells us that now. Yeah, why aren't we taking the lessons from that and saying, well, connection is the way forward? I also kind of am interested about your interest in the language and Tsleil-Waututh Machin. Are you learning Tsleil-Waututh Machin?
Little bits and pieces. Please don't ask me to speak it. I think it is important to learn, and we're so fortunate that we still have fluent Tsleil-Waututh speakers who have been able to put together the dictionaries and the language lessons, and we have Chief Atom School. I mean, we had members from the Songhees language team actually go out to Chase to learn from the people of my territory, which is really cool. So as incredible as it is, I can't say that I'm as well-versed in the language as I would like to be, but it's definitely on my radar. I would like to get into the language, I think. Yeah, I mean, I have all the support in the world to do it. I just need to practice. Yeah.
Well, so does everybody, right? Like, you, if you really want something bad enough, you have to practice it. It just doesn't come to you as a gift, right? Yeah. Good for you. I mean, I've met many people who are trying to learn little bits and pieces, just basically, you know, greetings and words that describe the land and the people. And it's just something really special, I think, to imagine a land-based language, that it was an oral tradition that is only able to be revised if we're speaking it, if everybody is speaking it. So, yeah, it's kind of an interest to me, too, that there be language learning opportunities in every community.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's coming. You know, just like me, I didn't know I could speak it until 10, 15 years ago. So I think it's embedded in everybody, also Tsleil-Waututh people, you know, just having the desire to learn it. And it'll come. It's like it did to us with the English language. And
that's what we need, though. We need immersion. We need Tsleil-Waututh immersion.
Yeah. Well, my grandmother, I didn't know that she could read. She had the Chinook Bible, and that's what she learned. She must have self-taught herself, or maybe one of the priests taught her. to read it, but I remember her with the, she had a Chinook Bible and she was reading from it. She could recite the whole Mass in Suwakmuk Jean, everything. That's how devout Catholic she was. I laughed there when, because, you know, they're a real firm believer in the spirit world. And she grew up, my girls, Kathy, Nancy, and Lillian grew up with her, their Uncle Bill's daughter, because they lost their mother when they were young. And Kia'a raised them. And now I was given to Kia'a as a baby. So I kind of really grew up with them. And they were almost constantly being ghosted. They'd be laying in bed there and all of a sudden one leg over there by the, against the wall hanging over. I'm getting ghosted. Something got my leg. Kia'a would come out with a smudge bowl and smudge the whole house. Then as soon as she finished that, out would come that little vial of holy water. Start splashing it around. When I got a little bit older, I call it double whamming the ghost. Making sure smuds and holy water. Mm-hmm. She always carried around a little bottle of holy water too. And so that was, that was one of the cross-cultural things that some of our people retained. So they had to revert to two, not just to one smudging. Once I started relearning the culture, and I realized that's why people do things a certain way all the time.
That connection to spirituality and the indigenous connection, you know, we have that kind of idea of the mystical Indian. But I think there's a lot to be learned. I mean, yeah. We have these connections now to the natural world, but the spiritual world was a huge part of indigenous cultures across BC, across North America. And I love hearing, I guess, supernatural stories from our local communities. I mean, I have some memories of getting chased out when we were kids. Do you remember? And we had, the whole family had to drive up to Kamloops or something, and you smudged the house. You gave it a deep clean after we had a funeral. And I remember we hightailed it out of there. But just little things like that that you carry in your own family that feel taboo or silly to talk about. But I eat that stuff up. I love those kinds of stories.
Yeah. Medicine people played important in our role. Actually, when you think about it, you know, our chief and council they got now, you know what? If the chief couldn't make a final decision, it was the medicine man, he made the final decision. And people never argued with him because they're scared he might put a spell on them. That's why they didn't argue with him. So now, see, that's what our politics doesn't have anymore, is that one who makes the final decision, and that word is law. And we've lost that. Now the chief makes the decision, he takes the whole onus. They can't blame the medicine man anymore. but the people were scared of the medicine people because they knew things that other people didn't know. Never leave your hair around. Always burn it. Because the medicine man will use that as a part of a spell against you, because apparently that's where he creates a lot of his big medicine. So I always make sure I take mine off the brush and burn it.
The last time I got my hair cut, actually, my hairdresser, she was indigenous from out east, and she asked if I wanted my hair in a bag. And I'd never heard of that before. I said, Why would I want that? What's going on here? And she said, well, you better take it home and burn it. Yeah. Okay, so she sent me home with a little grocery bag of my own hair.
Yeah, that way a lot of our old people think, you know, the superstition. Our people, that's why they were so easy to conform. Because the fear of burning in eternal hell was, people were scared of it, I guess. So it was easy to convert them into Catholicism or whatever. That fear of burning. Nobody wanted to burn in eternal fire. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing about spirituality, I suppose, right? Like you talked about earlier about how there's so many similarities between different religions. It's just really about control.
Yeah.
And so
we've lost our spirituality, but we got starting to intermix with other beliefs, you know, like the sun dancing is one of the biggest ones. You know, they're kind of often in the background a little bit, you know, people are practicing the sun dancing, and I think it was some of the people up at Invermere were saying, what do you think of sun dancers? And I said, well, they're all right, as long as they don't harm the people. And what I think is they're going to gather a whole bunch of different beliefs and put it all together and maybe come up with our own spirituality. Who knows?
What is the sun dance?
I don't really know. I know they dance and kind of talk politics, I think.
It's a practice from the prairies. They have a large, they erect a huge pole, and then all of the young men actually pierce sticks through their chests, and they tie themselves to this pole, and they dance around it. I can't, is it, I don't know if it's days or hours. I'm not a professional.
Until they could break it off.
Until they pull it off. And they'll be, it's quite gruesome.
It just made a face.
Yeah.
But they call it sacred pain, is being able to withstand that kind of pain. I think it's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we had that instance up at Chipetan in the 90s, but the Sundance isn't generally something that we practice here.
They had it over Chilliwack too for a while, because one of the Alexanders took part in it, and even had the scars on his chest to prove it. He did it. So I don't know if they do that anymore. I think they just go up and they dance until they maybe keel over or something. Yeah, who knows? Because I think it's pretty brutal if you put a stake through both your chest or one and keep dancing until it falls off.
But I think, can't imagine it's an enjoyable Sunday afternoon. So,
I read a little bit about the ghost dancing. And to me, I think that makes more sense, where the... You want all the confederacy of all the nations to get together and start talking. People thought it was a big threat, so they went after the Sioux and the Lakota and all of them, because they started talking about getting the people. I guess it started there for a while. All the bands were starting to get together and doing the ghost dance. So it kind of scared the government into thinking that there was going to be a big uprising of all the native people. And so they started attacking. That's where the Trail of Tears came in, I think, and all of that, So, but, I think that idea about uniting the bands might be a good thing. And it'd be like any other politics, where they end up fighting each other again. And
well, there's already been such a borrowing from each other, too. Like, we've talked before about the powwow and totems and how there's all these kind of understood cultural things that are very specific to certain areas, certain regions. But there's been a lot of borrowing and sharing. And it's from your perspective, it's all kind of okay. It's whatever's working for you.
As long as it don't damage the people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They asked Mike, is it on tape, too? He said, did your people do many ceremonies? Oh, no, we're too busy. They're out hunting and gathering all the time, so how could they do times for a ceremony? Usually the one is that the chief was the first one to get the first salmon or the first berry or something. Once he had a taste of it, then he said it was open to everybody to eat. But that's the only one I came across, and, they never had no big celebration because, the salmon are coming, Or, because they're always out in the land, surviving, and it's the main issue. When they talk, they sometimes a little fear-monger saying, we're going to hit into a famine. And I walked around this fall there, and I seen a whole bunch of chokecherries hanging up in the tree yet, and there's some Oregon grapes still clinging to the vines. They say, look at all this food laying up around there. And we're talking about famine. And I keep reminding people, it sustained our people for thousands of years, and yet look at this, we're ignoring it. Maybe it could sustain our people, right across Canada for another thousands of years, but we don't look at it that way. We expect our food to be imported from all over the world, and we rely on that kind of food. But yet, you look right across Canada, how much land we got that we don't really use, cut down the trees or extract all ore from it, and it probably could sustain us for thousands of years too, like it did our people.
Louis, Christina, thank you so much for sharing today and doing it together. This was such a treat for all of us. And I wish you a wonderful trip back to the island. And I hope that you'll join us again sometime.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.